So last week, there at the Lord's Supper time, I was talking to you about Hebrews chapter 10, but I didn't read the whole chapter or anything. And I felt like I wasn't quite clear, maybe. I didn't say it as well as I like. So I'm just going to read the whole chapter as our opening scripture. And I want to reiterate maybe a little differently what I said to make sure that I came across the way I meant to. But, well, I guess it weren't there. So. Hebrews chapter 10 says, "For since the law has but a shadow of the good things to come, instead of the true form of its realities, it can never, by the same sacrifices that are continually offered every year, make perfect those who draw near. Otherwise, would they not have ceased to be offered, since the worshippers, having once been cleansed, would no longer have any consciousness of sins? But in these sacrifices, there is a reminder of sins every year. For it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. Consequently, when Christ came into the world, he said, 'Sacrifices and offerings you have not desired, but a body have you prepared for me. In burnt offerings and sin offerings you have taken no pleasure.' Then I said, 'Behold, I have come to do your will, O God, as it is written of me in the scroll of the book.' When he said above, 'You have neither desired nor taken pleasure in sacrifices and offerings and burnt offerings and sin offerings,' these are offered according to the law. Then he added, 'Behold, I have come to do your will.' He does away with the first in order to establish the second. And by that will we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. And every priest stands daily at his service, offering repeatedly the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins. But when Christ had offered for all time a single sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God, waiting from that time until his enemies should be made a footstool for his feet. For by a single offering, he has perfected for all time those who are being sanctified. And the Holy Spirit also bears witness to us, for after saying, 'This is the covenant that I will make with them after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my laws on their hearts and write them on their minds.' Then he also adds, 'I will remember their sins and their lawless deeds no more.' Where there is forgiveness of these, there is no longer any offering for sin." Okay, that's the relevant part. So what I was trying to say was, I was most interested in the section where it talked about, it's in verse 2, "Otherwise would they not have ceased to be offered, since the worshipers, having once been cleansed, would no longer have any consciousness of sins." This is not, I just want to make it clear, this is not that your conscience won't let you know that you have sinned. It means that you will not have a conscience that says, "My sins are not okay, have not been taken care of." Because what happened was, what this is telling us is that in the old covenant, they would come, they would bring their offerings, but their conscience said, "This is not quite enough. This doesn't quite do the job." So they would come back next year, do it again. And their conscience would say, maybe for a time, "I did what I was supposed to do." But then it would be like, "I just know that's not enough." So what the Hebrews is saying is, if it had been enough, they would have come, they would have made that, they had brought that lamb, that dove, whatever it was they were bringing, they would have been done, they would have gone, "Enough. This is done what needs to happen. I don't need to do this again." That's what they would have said. And so, what we can say, we should say, as believers is, my sins have been forgiven once and for all. The cross was enough. I don't need to do anything else except believe that that was what was done. Okay? So, I just want to make sure I made it clear. That doesn't mean that after you're saved, you won't, your conscience won't prick you to say, yep, that was disobeying God's law. That's not the same thing as what they're saying here. What they're saying is, what you can say to yourself is, yes, that was disobedience. Thankfully, not only that disobedience, not only all the past disobediences, but even all the future disobediences have been cared for on the cross. Let's pray. Thank you, God, for another day that you can remind us of your truth. I pray that will be true today, and that you will bless our time here. In Jesus' name, amen. All right. We are now going to finish, hopefully, Daniel chapter 2. So you can turn there if you like. And while you're doing that, I ran across some additional information regarding the book of Daniel and the structure that I think is relevant and should be taken into consideration. Apparently, the book of Daniel was actually composed in two different languages. It was partly in Hebrew and partly in Aramaic. The introductory chapter 1 and a couple of verses in chapter 2, remember, chapters and all that's arbitrary, was in Hebrew. Then, and starting in chapter 2, verse 4, through the end of chapter 7, was written Aramaic. And Aramaic would have been the common language of the Gentile world from the perspective of a Jew. And then 8 through the end of the book, through 12, was back to Hebrew, written in Hebrew. And the thought for this is that the book, the different parts of the book were written in a language because what's in that section of the book is really more directed, or the context is for that group of people. Not that you can't learn from the whole book, but so where we are now in chapter 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 is the audience, the general audience would have been like for the Gentile world. And then when we get to 8, the rest of the book would be focused to the Hebrews, to the Jewish nation. Not that you can't learn from both, but I think that makes a lot of sense. And if you look at the what's in those sections, I think that it doesn't take away from that idea. So there's a couple of times where I'm going to stop in the middle and I'm going to like say, okay, let's apply that idea to what we just heard. And when we get there, maybe it will be something that you agree this makes it, not that it makes a difference, but that it's like helpful. Maybe you won't. Remember, there's nothing in the text that says that this is the case. It's just that, why would it be written in two different languages to start with? We're just trying to figure out maybe why that happened, why that may be important. Because I don't know of any other book that was written that way. So this is a bit of an anomaly, best I can tell. So, anyway, verse 31 says, okay, everybody remembers last week, for the Wygants, last week was King Nebuchadnezzar has a dream, and he He brings in all his wise men, and he's like, "Tell me what my dream was and what it means." And they're like, "Hey, we can't do that. No earthly man can do that." And they're about to kill all the wise men. He says, "All right, fine. If you can't do it, kill it all." And then Daniel says, "Wait, wait, wait a minute," because he's one of the wise guys. He says, "Wait a minute. Give me a minute to ask my God." Because remember, these are pagan folks, by the way, Paul's, I have something here, right quick. This is a freebie, in case you're interested. Should have already had this, but I did have it, but then I lost it. In case you're interested, that's apparently how you're supposed to say the word Chaldeans. Just thought I'd point that out. Chaldeans. Now I gotta find where I was. But you can do it however you want to, but that's just. So Daniel prays to God. Daniel and his friends pray to God, and God reveals the dream and what it means. So he goes to the king, says, "O king, I know what the dream means." And he says, "Great." And now is when Daniel is telling the king what the dream is and what it means. Verse 31 says, "You, O king, were looking, and behold, there was a single great statue. That statue, which was large and of extraordinary splendor, was standing in front of you, and its appearance was awesome," is what the NASB translates that. So, in the dream, the king sees a large an imposing statue. That I get the word imposing because another rendering for the word there, awesome, is terrible. So there was a. So it was not just. It was not just large. It was oppressive in the sense that the statue was. It wasn't sitting there smiling at it. It was terrible. It was all. You were in awe of it. That was so. It was a statue that was had a personality to it in a sense. This was a statue with. It was terrible, and then it says the head of the statue was made of fine gold, its breast and arms of silver, its belly and its thighs of bronze, its legs of iron. His feet partly of iron and partly of clay. It says, "You continued looking until a stone was cut out without hands, and it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and crushed them." Now, in just a minute, Daniel's going to give the interpretation of what the statue, what all these different details of the statue mean. And so we're going to really get into it mostly when we get to that point. However, to start with, though, I did want to point out that although it says the head of the statue is fine gold, and we're going to learn that the head represented Babylon, it did not necessarily, Babylon was not necessarily the first world empire. However, the statue, it being the head at the top, because as every time it's described, they start at the head and they work down the body of the statue. And so the head is representative of where we're starting from. And even though there have been other world powers, umpires, this statue and what it's talking about is starting with Babylon as the head, Babylon being the first as it goes through. And to me, I mean, what it seemed like was this is given to Nebuchadnezzar now, and so this is about now and the future. It's not really about the past. So starting with Babylon is the head, sort of represents, okay, this is about now and the future. In fact, even the head itself, even the Empire of Babylon itself, is going to have, you know, it's going to go on into the future for a while. So this is a prophecy in the sense of it's a future. It's telling the future, okay, proclaiming the future. And it's interesting that Daniel here is apparently God gave him what the dream was, and not only did God give him what the dream was, it looks like that God gave Daniel a vision. I'm getting this. My interpretation would be if I had a dream, I would be sick. If I was Nebuchadnezzar and I'm having the dream, I'm seeing the statue. I'm not seeing me seeing the statue. From my perspective in my dream. That's the way I would think. That's the way I would dream. That's the way I do dream. So I'm assuming that's the way he saw his vision. But it seems like Daniel is seeing Nebuchadnezzar see the dream, because Daniel then says, "You continued looking." So either Daniel saw it from the king's perspective, just like the king saw it in his perfectly, and he realized that in the dream the king is watching the statue, and not just he doesn't just see it, but he's like continuing to look at it until, you know, it says until. And then it tells you what happens next. So I just thought it was interesting that the king in his vision is not, it's not just a snapshot vision. It's not just, he just, you know, sees the statue. It's like there's an actual kind of progress to the dream, to the vision. Again, I don't attribute any particular significance, but I thought it was interesting that possibly Daniel was giving a vision of the king watching the vision. So I thought that was interesting. And the stone here, it says, was cut out. Now, it doesn't say here what it was cut out of, but we're going to find out in the interpretation what it was cut out of. I'm not sure we're going to do that, but it was cut out. And this word cut out also means determined. It was determined, and it says without hands. And the without hands is actually, I think, probably the more important. And that literally means by no power. So that what that's attributing to this stone is that this wasn't, you know, man-made. This was autonomously there. It was autonomously determined to do what it did. It was not a subject to anything. It was by no power. No power did this. It did it of its own power. And all this is going to become, a little bit more relevant as we find out what this stone was or who this stone represented. And we get that later in the interpretation of the thing. But we wanted to point it out now. Interesting also, it strikes the statue on its feet, which would be an odd place for like a military attack to take place, if you were going to be attacking something, you would attack, you know, a vital area like the head or the chest, apparently vital. What we're going to find out is that I think this stone striking defeat is another time reference. So that's just a little spoiler for what's coming. But it does, the stone that was cut without hands strikes the statue on its feet and crushes them. And then later we're going to find more information about that. It says 35, then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold, working back up now from the bottom to the top, were crushed all at the same time and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them was found. So everybody know what chaff is? You know what chaff is?
Yes, sir.
You do? No? No? Chaff, okay, like if you grow wheat, then you harvest it when it's really dry. You let it go to complete maturity, it gets completely dry, brittle. Like you could go out there and just kind of rub it and it'll just fall apart. So when they would cut the wheat down, then they had the whole piece of the grass with the head as well. And then they would thresh it, which means they would rub it or beat it, and that would separate the kernels of wheat from all the rest of the plant. The rest of the plant was called the chaff. And to get rid of the chaff, they would go to a threshing floor and they would find a windy spot and they would toss it up in the air, and the wind would blow away the very light particles of the chaff, and the heavy kernels of wheat would fall back down. So it would get rid of the chaff, and it would get rid of it, and it would have it ground down so fine that when they threw it up in the air and the wind blew it away, it was almost like it just disappeared, because it was so fine. When you know, you didn't land in a pile, it just sort of just dissipated over everything. This is the picture that this is given, that the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were ground. They were crushed to a point where they were so fine that it just into the wind and went away. And you couldn't even find it. So it was destroyed so completely that it was unable to be put back together. That is sort of the picture here that's going on. It says, but the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain. It filled the whole earth. So the stone strikes the feet. The statue basically just pulverizes to the point, and the wind blows it away like chaff in the wind. And then the stone starts growing into this mountain that filled the whole earth. And the word struck here is not just hit or rammed into, but it actually has the connotation of a military strike. It another way to say it is the word smote. It's an older word. We don't use it much, but it means hit to kill. So like literally in the word is the purpose of this impact was to destroy. Okay? And that brings to mind, you know, basically right off the bat, David with the sling and the stone. He smote Goliath with his stone. Okay? It gives you the idea. This is, just to remind everybody, we were in Matthew. Pretty much all was all written in Greek. Right? We're now in Daniel. This is actually in Aramaic, this section, right? Most of the Old Testament is in Hebrew. But, so, the way it says the word earth here, you know, and Matthew had several times where we were kind of trying to figure out what it mean by the whole earth, right? The whole world. This is not the same word because we're in a different language. But the word here, earth, is the word for land or world. So it just means the whole everything that you could see, everything that it looked like, it filled everything. Okay, and here it says filled the whole earth, and We are going to find out. So this, there's almost no way to me to do this unless I just read it to you and then go straight to interpretation and give you everything in interpretation. So I've kind of like blending the two. But we're going to find out that this mountain. I'm going to save it. I'm going to save it and I'm going to come back to this. Y'all remind me when I get to the mountain that I got to come back to this little section right here. Because in 45, we find out what the mountain was. So I'm going to wait. Verse 36 says, this was the dream. This is Daniel talking. Daniel says, this was the dream. Now we will tell its interpretation before the king. We don't know who the we was here. We do know that he went in with the captain of the guard. What was that dude's name?
Arioch.
However, I wonder also if Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were with him, to use their Babylonian names. We don't know, but it says, we will tell us interpretation. Remember, they all four of them were the one got together, prayed to God. So they're kind of doing this as a team on the front end. So maybe they're all there together now. Maybe not. It doesn't tell us. However, Daniel says, we will tell us interpretation before the king. And now in 37, here's the interpretation. Actually, there's a little introduction to the interpretation with Daniel. Again, takes the opportunity to remind Nebuchadnezzar of his submission to God, of his need for submission to God, of his place before God, and that he is not God. He says, you, O king, are the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom. So right off the bat, yeah, you're king of all the kings of the earth, but you're not king over God. You're only king because God has given you this kingdom. The God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory. That should sound a little bit familiar, right? Deuteronomy 6, I believe. And wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he has given them into your hand and has caused you to rule over them all. You are the head of gold. So there we go. Got plain as day. What is the head of gold? The head of gold is Nebuchadnezzar, representative as king of the Babylonian Empire. And again, he says it twice. He says, God has given you this kingdom, and he's the one who caused you to rule. Now, there's multiple verses. I didn't write them all down, but the multiple verses in the prophets in the Old Testament that speak to God as God using Nebuchadnezzar, sending Nebuchadnezzar as his instrument of judgment. Whenever it's spoken of like that, it's spoken of in parallel. It says, God judged Israel. God sent Nebuchadnezzar to judge Israel. It's the same thing happening. So if you read, God judged whatever, okay? Historically, that is routinely happened. God sends his judgment. It's his judgment. He will send it, and he'll accomplish it through the means of other men. So here, God caused you to rule over them. And the word cause there implies for a reason. Why did God give Nebuchadnezzar the kingdom of Babylon? Why did he allow this to happen? Well, at least one reason was so that they could go and destroy, and then they could bring the judgment on Israel that God wanted to happen. Another will be later, we'll find, he's going to take the opportunity to make Nebuchadnezzar understand his position before him. And then we're going to see as we go through this statue and what it means that God has a plan, a purpose to bring all these kingdoms about for a final purpose, a final reason and accomplish his goal. So he's got more than one goal. But God gave, according to Daniel, God gave this kingdom and power to Nebuchadnezzar for a purpose to rule. And the purpose right now is for him to rule over all. And when it says all the, basically he's saying over all the men, over everything. You have, you in Babylon, like Assyria before, was sort of like, I looked up some maps. I wanted to see, like, did Babylon cover, like, more area than anybody else before? It doesn't appear that they were that much broader in their scope. But what was happening was the majority of the known civilization was underneath their rule. And at this time, it was, you know, those were the major centers of civilization in the world, apparently. So he ruled over all. 39 says, after, okay, so we dealt with the head. This is where he tells who the head was. We kind of talked about a little bit more before. Head being, so the head was the start of the statue. So the prophecy and the vision is starting now in terms of, like, you know, starting here at Babylon at the time of Daniel. And so everything that was going to be from here forward is going into the future. Because it says, after you, and the you here would be Nebuchadnezzar, right? Because he's talking to Nebuchadnezzar. After you, there will arise another kingdom inferior to you. So even though in 37-38, he's talking about, he says, you are the head. This is where we get the idea that this is not just Nebuchadnezzar as an individual being the head, but you as the king are the head, and the king implies the head is Nebuchadnezzar and the whole kingdom of Babylon. Because the next section is about another kingdom, implies there was a previous kingdom, the head. Everybody with me? Okay. So another kingdom inferior to you, then another kingdom of bronze will rule over all the earth. And that, so we got the torso of the statue in silver, that's another kingdom. Then we got the hips and thighs of the statue, that's another kingdom. And that's all we get of those two kingdoms, which is real interesting, because they don't get a whole lot about the head. But that seems like, okay, you know, kind of already know about, oh, Nebuchadnezzar, you know about the head. You are the head, right? Then there's not much given, and then there's going to be a whole bunch given about the from the knees down on the statue. However, chapter 8 gives more information, apparently, because historically we know that the kingdom after Babylon was the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. And in chapter 8, there's another vision Daniel has. And it's a vision with different symbols in it. But in chapter 8, it actually, in verse 20, it actually tells in there that this ram in this vision in chapter 8 represents the kings of Media and Persia. Now, Media and Persia at this time were places. They weren't a kingdom yet. I mean, they were a kingdom in the sense that they had kings, and they weren't a world power yet or anything like that. It says it represents the kings of the Media and Persia. And then 21, there's a goat in chapter 8 that represents the kingdom of Greece. And it gives these sequentially. So what wasn't known now is that the next world power will be Media and Persia. That's revelatory in the vision. Of course, the Babylonians, the king Nebuchadnezzar, say, hey, we're going to reign forever. Nobody can defeat us. But this speaks differently. And then, I mean, and for sure nobody knew that the Greece was going to be the next kingdom. But this is what these things are telling. Now, so we know historically that this other kingdom, number one, was the Media and Persian kingdom, and then this third kingdom were the Greeks. Now, I'm going to go ahead and let's read 40 through 43, finish out the statute. Then there will be a fourth kingdom, as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all things. So like iron that breaks in pieces, it will crush and break all these in pieces. In that you saw the feet and toes partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it, meaning the kingdom that is describing here, this fourth kingdom, it will be a divided kingdom, but it will have in it the toughness of iron, inasmuch as you saw the iron mixed with common clay. As the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong and part of it will be brittle. So now we're talking about the qualities of the different materials here. Iron is very strong. Clay, like pottery, ceramics, brittle. When it breaks and then it's brittle. In that you saw the iron mixed with common clay, they will combine with one another in the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, even as iron does not combine with pottery. Okay, so this is where I think I would like to point out that maybe we can take this application of the different languages and the fact that the section we're in now was written in Aramaic, and so this is a section more focused on the audience of the Gentiles. And what we'll find is chapter 8, written in Hebrew, more focused on the audience being of the Hebrews, of the Jewish nation. And so, to me, what I'm seeing is I'm going to see very little information about Media, Persia, and Greece. And I got a whole bunch of detail about this last kingdom. And so, I just wanted to point that out. It seems like that might be I may kind of go toward this idea that these two, the Median Persian and Greek empires, and what's going on there is going to be more relevant to the Jewish nation than this other. Now, this fourth kingdom, there's little debate that this is Rome. This is the Roman Empire. This fourth kingdom. Historically, it was the next empire after Greece. So it fits with the flow of the empires, of the kingdoms. It also, the idea of the feet and toes being some iron and some clay mixes very well. Now, so this was a statue, and in this time, basically, their foot gear would be sandals and open foot gear for the main part. So actually, you'd be able to visualize the toes. Like today, if it was a soldier, the toes wouldn't be visible. It'd be inside a boot or something, probably. But I always thought that when it said mixed, it meant like, each toe had iron and clay in it. But it looks more like possibly you had some toes of iron, some toes of clay. So they're mixed. They're mixed in the sense that the toes are not all clay or all iron. And the idea for that comes from the fact that the Roman Empire, it ended up branching into 10 kingdoms. And some of the kingdoms were ruled by strong leaders, and some were ruled by very weak leaders. And that's the visualization of the iron and the clay being mixed. So the kingdom of Rome, the Roman Empire, became mixed. And it was toward the end of the empire, which made it vulnerable to falling. Does that make sense? Maybe. And I also found it interesting that in verse 33, when we have the description of the statue, that it just mentions the feet. But here it actually gives more details, and I think this also lends to, you know, why are there more details? Well, so that we can further and more clearly understand who this fourth kingdom is. So these details become important for that. So the fourth kingdom appears to be the Roman Empire, which is important to know because of the next verse. Because the next verse starts by saying, in those days. So that is a time stamp about what it's fixing to say. So in those days, in what days? In the days of the fourth kingdom. Okay? Days of the fourth kingdom. This next thing happens. And this is very important for us as Gentile believers, because as Gentiles, we were not there were ways to be included, but on the grand scope of things, we were not included in the covenant as Gentiles. The covenant people were the people of the Jews. But here we're going to read, it says, in those days, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed. Now, was the Jewish kingdom destroyed? It was destroyed. The Jewish kingdom was destroyed. So this is not it's not talking about the Jewish kingdom here. This is a kingdom that will never be destroyed. And that kingdom, says, will not be left for another people. The Babylonian kingdom was left to the Persians. The Persians overcame it. Also, what happens in the kingdom when the king dies? It's left to the heir, right? So the kingdom gets left to the next. So this tells us a couple things. Number one, the kingdom never goes away. So it's never left to a new people in that respect. Also, the king of this kingdom never dies. It's never left to another king. It's never left for another people in the sense of, like, you know, in the broad sense, and it's never left to another person in the narrow sense, it's never left to another king. The king never dies. It will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms. This new kingdom that happens in the days of the fourth kingdom crushes all the rest of them. Well, we already know what crushed it, right? In the vision, what crushed it? The stone that became a mountain. So that tells us what the mountain was. Okay? The mountain, that tells us what the mountain was. And so in 44 it says, it will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, but it itself will endure forever. So he says twice, kingdom that will never end will endure forever. Just reiterating the same point. Now, so like I said, it's very important, the timestamp in those days. So we don't have to worry about what is this next kingdom that will never end. Right? Well, it's a kingdom that occurred and was created or came to be in the days of the fourth kingdom, in the days of the Roman Empire. So, can anybody think of a kingdom that was established in the days of the Roman Empire? Kingdom of Christ. Christ came, established his kingdom. He said it over and over and over. This is beautiful. It reflects right back to Matthew. We just got through doing that. This is a vision of the coming of Messiah and establishing the kingdom that will never end. This is the Messianic kingdom. But this is not the Jewish kingdom. This is a new kingdom, it says. Kingdom that never ends. So, this is another way that I see this interpretation based on the different languages flowing with what's going on here. Here's this information going to the Gentiles that there will be a new kingdom established that will never end. This is important for you guys. So, because the Jewish kingdom was already there. The Jewish kingdom was there, now it was in captivity, but God had already described, he had already set a limit on how long that was going to happen. He set the limit at 70 years, and then you're going to go back, and you're going to rebuild, you're going to become a kingdom again. You're going to become a nation again. And yet, there's nothing like that said about what happens after AD 70. They're not coming back. There's no indication that they're coming back again, not in the scriptures. So, if we think about this, if we go back to 35 now, which is what I had in the 35 section, and we say we have this stone that became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. And now we know that this stone, what was this stone? Anybody have an idea what the stone was?
Jesus Christ.
Jesus Christ was the stone. And I'm going to go ahead and read 45, and then I'm going to do some more. It says, because 44 goes, it says, it will endure forever. And 45 says, inasmuch as you saw that a stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it crushed the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will take place in the future. So the dream is true, and its interpretation is trustworthy. So there's a reminding that there was a stone, and this stone, it says here, cut out of the mountain and became a mountain. The stone here is an emblem of the Messiah. There are multiple places where it speaks of this. All right, here we go. Ready to look up some stuff? Genesis 49:24. Raise your hand right quick if you got it. That's Nate's. Psalm 118:22. He's got that, Titus. Isaiah 8:14. William. Isaiah 28:16. Zechariah 3:8. Titus? My Titus? I'm going to say them again because I know y'all don't need me to repeat it. Genesis 49:24, Nate. Psalm 118:22. Got it, Titus?
Psalm 118.
I get it. Isaiah 8:14. Isaiah 28:16. Zechariah 3:8. Okay. Ready, Nate? Go.
Yet his bow remained unmoved. His arms were made agile by the hands of the mighty one of Jacob. From there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel.
Stone of Israel. Shepherd. Well, all, you know, you should recognize Jesus as the great shepherd, right? As the good shepherd.
118:22. The stone which the builders refused is become the headstone of the corner.
Okay, stone. We're familiar with that verse. Isaiah 8:14.
He will be as a sanctuary, but a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense to both the houses of Israel, as a trap and a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem.
Okay. 28:16.
Therefore, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I lay in Zion for a foundation a stone, a tried stone, a precious cornerstone, a sure foundation. He that believeth shall not make haste.
And Zechariah. Or Zechariah.
Hear now, O Joshua the high priest, you and your friends who sit before you. For they are men who are a sign. Behold, I will bring my servant the branch.
The branch? Okay. So the stone that smites the statue at the feet, representative of when it happens. The stone comes at the feet. Okay? The stone comes at the feet. It smites the statue. The result is the statue is completely, utterly destroyed, pulverized, and goes away into nothingness, it seems. Just like chaff in the wind. And so the mountain is a result of the stone. The mountain grows from the stone. It says that's the vision. We're not making this. I mean, the interpretation here is given to us by God. The stone becomes the mountain. The mountain grows. The mountain is based on the stone. It grows and becomes, and it fills the whole land. Whatever your land is, it fills it. Okay? So, the mountain becomes and then grows. Now, the stone comes, Jesus Christ comes. It's interesting, Jesus Christ comes at the heyday of Roman Empire. I mean, they are close to their peak. They are right up there at the top of their curve. He comes, and of course, we all know that he comes as an infant, as a baby. He has his ministry, he lives, he dies, he's resurrected, and it appears, if you just look at the surface, it appears there's been no impact on Rome. But we don't have to look at appearances, because the interpretation of the vision is that this was the death knell of not only Rome, but all of man's power, all of man's empires. In the interpretive sense, all his empires, gone. And the mountain begins to grow. And the mountain is going to fill everything. There's not going to be any room for man's empires when the mountain is fully grown. And so the whole imagery here is that the stone comes and it strikes the fourth kingdom, and the mountain grows. And all that happens. And so the fact that Jesus Christ comes, has his ministry, is resurrected, and even comes again in 70 years in 70 to accomplish the destruction of the Jews and the Jewish empire as one of those empires that falls, because it become a man-centered empire at this point. It wasn't God-centered. He comes, he does all of this, and in history is still 300 years before the final fall, that final brittleness gets to the point where it crushes and everything falls apart. That's fine and dandy, because the audience here is not the Jews. So if you're honest with the Jews, you might feel like, you know, everything was over at 70. But everything wasn't over 70. The mountain hadn't finished everything that it was doing. It was still growing. And so it's no problem that, you know, it was AD 300 or something before Rome really kind of completely fell apart finally in every aspect. So there's no problem there with interpretation. So historically, God uses Rome to destroy the Jews, but Christ's kingdom is what took down Rome. And the Roman Empire, a derivative of the previous three empires, was crushed and blown away as chaff, never to be seen again. If you believe the scriptures, you would know the Third Reich was never going to come to fruition. And going back to 35, this great mountain fills the whole earth. Mark 16:15 is the Great Commission. But Jesus says, go out and preach the gospel and go to all the world. So this was inherent in the Great Commission. that the whole world would be full of the gospel. In fact, in many ways, that was accomplished very soon. Peter, Paul, and John all testified the gospel had gone to all the earth. Jesus, even in Matthew 24, says the gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all the nations when the end of the age comes. This was in the context of the destruction of Jerusalem. Remember, they're talking specifically to the Jews here, so this is their word. This is the word to them. Their age was coming to an end. And so the mountain is the kingdom of Christ, which is and will fill the whole earth. That's what the prophecy, that's what the vision says it will do. In fact, this vision can be, we can utilize this vision and this part of the vision as we consider Jesus' parable in Matthew 21. This was the parable of the vineyard tenants. Remember that? The tenants say, I think we'll just keep all this by ourselves. They killed the owner's son, etc. Well, in Matthew 21:43, Jesus is talking to the Jewish leaders here, but he tells them, therefore I tell you that the kingdom of God, the true kingdom, will be taken away from you and given to a people who will produce its fruit. Anyone who falls on this stone will be broken to pieces. Anyone on whom it falls will be crushed. And the chief priests and Pharisees, they knew he was talking about them. So now we have had the interpretation of the vision. King Nebuchadnezzar knows what his dream was. There's some speculation. I agree with Benjamin that he had not forgotten his dream. He was just making these people tell him his dream so that they wouldn't cheat him again. But anyway, he knows his dream and its interpretation, and the result. In verse 46 through 49, then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face and did homage to Daniel and gave orders to present to him an offering and fragrance and incense. The king answered Daniel and said, surely your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery. Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. And Daniel made requests of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the administration of the province of Babylon while Daniel was at the king's court. Now, I read all that just blah, 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 blah. However, it doesn't actually flow that well if you're listening to what's actually being said. 46, King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face and did homage to Daniel. So what happens here is the king tries to worship Daniel. This is not uncommon. The king himself, we're going to find out in the next chapter, presents himself as deity in a way. The kings of the time were seen as partial deities. It had already been elucidated in the previous part of the chapter that no man on earth could do this. This information that the king requested would have to come from outside of mortal men. So for Daniel to do this was like, it came across as an expression of deity. So the king, tries to do what would come natural to the pagans at that time, that is to worship. In fact, others tried, others that we respect improperly or accidentally tried to worship the wrong. Isaiah, and I saw it right off the bat, Isaiah fell on his face before the angels and they said, nope, get up. John did the same thing when he encountered angelic beings. So, I'm not, I mean, this this is it was a mistake by the king, but not necessarily one to be, you know, we might make the same mistake. However, the next verse says, the king answered Daniel. Well, where did that come from? We don't have anything here that says Daniel told the king anything. But apparently he did, because the king answers Daniel. We don't know what Daniel said to the king, but most likely he's saying the same thing the angel said to John. No, get up. I'm not the one you need to be worshiping here. We don't know. I'm not going to dwell on that. But he said something, because the king answers him, and he answers him in a way that implies that that's what Daniel said. Because he says, oh, Daniel, your God is the great God. Your God is the one that should be worshipped in effect. And so that is a testimony to Daniel and to God and his power. And then lastly, the king promotes Daniel. This is a proper response, a wise response, I would say, from the king. I mean, what if somebody came in your life and was obviously in touch with truth, right? Would you want to maybe incorporate them into your counselors? I would, you know, that's a good reason to have. A good qualification for your counselor would be somebody who had proven wise and proven to have not special revelatory access to truth, but someone who can, you know, who can see truth and can apply it well in their life.
Humility and
yes.
Not lying to you.
Yes. All part of truth, right? But yes, good, you know, excellent to tease those out. And we saw all that in Daniel in this chapter. So Daniel is promoted, and I can't not point out that he's made prefect over the wise men. That means he was made head of the wise men. And remember, these are the same wise guys that come from the east to see the baby because they knew about the star. So I wonder where they learned about the star. I think it's from Daniel. That's just an awesome connection that I just can't keep from pointing out. Don't have any, you know, divinely inspired, you know, notification of that, but it sure seems like it fits to me. But, and lastly, Daniel didn't forget his friends. He requested that the king appoint Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego administrators over the province of Babylon. I think this was, you know, a wise move on Daniel. He's made part of the king's court. In some renderings, he's in the king's gate, meaning he's going to be making judgments, passing judgments in Babylon. And it would be very helpful for him to have people under him he could trust. Or maybe not under, but parallel with him. So he's not in always having to fight against these intrigues of the Babylonian guys. So I think that was probably pretty wise of him to do that. So toward the take home for this, number one, God is in control of all things. He raises up kings, he tears them down. Nations, empires, kings will do the bidding of our God. We can get that from the interpretation of the vision. Those kingdoms, as powerful as they appeared, came down in God's timing and God's way to be no more. In fact, we were watching a YouTube, Biblical Archaeology YouTube about Babylon. Was that this Friday? And it's pretty interesting that in the video, the guys had gone to the site of Babylon today, and they had taken lots of drone footage, so you had aerial of the whole area. And you can actually still see where the walls were of Babylon. There's kind of like, first of all, there's nothing built on top of it. There's this, from the aerial view, there's this corridor with where there's nothing on top of it. Probably because it's, you know, all the rock, nothing will grow well. I mean, there's a little bit of grass and stuff, but you know, this can't get deep rooted, and you can't, I guess, there's various reasons. You can still see like one of the big long walls, and they were superimposed, like they show you where the walls were, and you can still see the Euphrates River goes right beside the edge of the city, but it goes in a little different spot now. And you can see the old riverbed. Also, if you get up high enough, you can kind of see where the old riverbed was. So you can see the outline of ancient Babylon. And the guy's point, one of the guy's points was that, first of all, it was massively big. He talks about going to other places, like the city of Jericho. They found where the city of Jericho was, and they call it a tell, where it's this big high area where they've repetitively built on the same spot, so they kind of made it good. Because the rubble, they just would bring some dirt in, put it down, use it as a foundation, and build the next thing. So it got higher and higher and higher. And he said, you know, those tells would be a whole city, the whole city of Jericho. And yet you could walk across it in, I don't know, half an hour maybe. It's not that big. But the city of Babylon is like, you could fit multiple tells of those old cities inside this humongous area, the city of Babylon. And you ought to watch the video, because, you know, the prophecy was that Babylon will fall and nothing will live in it. There's still nothing living in it today.
Despite Saddam Hussein's best efforts.
Yeah, and it actually is interesting, because his palace is still standing, Saddam's palace. But if you go by the old riverbed, it's actually outside where the city of Babylon was. It's inside the current river, but it's outside the old riverbed, according to the guy on YouTube. I just take that at face value. But number two, take home. Christ has come. The stone the builders rejected has come. His kingdom, the mountain, is established. It is all-powerful. It will never be defeated, while all of man's kingdoms will be defeated. Number three, as Christians, as citizens of the kingdom, as those who live on the mountain of Christ, we need to live in the reality of what I just said about the mountain, what God said through the vision about the mountain, that the mountain is forever. The mountain will never end. The future is not only the past, the present, but also the future is the Lord's, and that all things are being made new as the mountain expands. The kingdom of Christ expands. And lastly, if we walk in that faith and believe, then we will have no need to fear. Should not cower to the world. We should proclaim the kingship of Christ over all things, and the ultimate and eventual, yes, not now, not yet, but will happen, certainty that the mountain will cover all the earth.